Hello, welcome back, everybody, to another year of the Sunday Podcast.
I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
Back in 2025 for our fifth season. You can expect more of this.
He's claiming that he was ill before the semifinal, whatever. But, you know, I just feel like at that point he was just looking for attention.
And some of this.
And you normally say no human is limited. So I can't limit myself, or I can't just say I can do.
As well as event coverage around all the major races on the UK circuit.
And if you're a fan of the pod, please give us a rating and review on your preferred podcast streaming service.
And if you want to stay up to date with all the latest news, give us a follow on Instagram at Sunday Podcast.
As always, thanks for listening. See you next time. And we hope you enjoyed the episode. Welcome back to another episode, everyone. And this week we have famed Irish coach Emmett Dunleavy. And importantly, he is now coach of the Wheelers, who we have a strong British interest with. So we'll be catching up on how that relationship came about as well. But firstly, Emmett, I mean, I always think it's interesting to know why people are coaching and how you got into coaching, especially someone like yourself who started off as an investment banker. Am I right?
It's correct. Yeah. Bit of a change of career in my early 30s.
So why did you choose for that change of career? Why did you opt to coaching?
I guess the move to coaching probably happened by accident. I had been in investment banking with the Bank of Ireland and State Street for 10 years. I went to change jobs, and it turned out that I'd handed in my notice. The job that I was moving to fell through. It was a startup company. The investors pulled out and I was left with no job for what was initially a couple of weeks. And I just started doing a little bit of coaching on the side because I had a bit more time on my hands. And then the coaching started to go places. I was probably finishing up my own running career as well. And never ended up going back. So here I am 12 years later, still coaching, and I won't be going back to investment banking anytime soon.
This is interesting though, because 12 years ago, I can't imagine there were too many coaching positions and roles that were paying you well. So when you say the coaching was going places after a few weeks, what did you see that you thought, actually, I can make a career out of this?
Well, initially I started off coaching club runners and recreational runners. So where the idea kind of came about really is after the Dublin Marathon one year, I sat down with a couple of guys. We had a couple of beers after the marathon with a few guys from my club at home in Sligo. And they were all being coached by a guy online in the States. And they were talking me through what they were doing. And I was like, well, maybe there's, you know, a bit of an opportunity here. So it turned out a couple of them were interested in kind of changing setup. So I started coaching a few of them, set up a website. And then, yeah, from there, like, I mean, really my first couple of years coaching was very much coaching club runners and recreational runners. And then after a period of time, I picked up two or three faster Irish guys who started running well. So Brian Maher, who was an Irish guy, Dara Fitzgibbon, and they started to perform well at a sort of a national level. And then it kind of grew from there. Got a couple of positions with a few clubs. I started working with the University College Dublin then as well. And yeah, just started to grow the group. And it's progressed quite nicely over the last 12 years.
Were you one of the first online coaches in 2014? There couldn't be many of you. Obviously, there was this guy in America.
Yeah, it was a pretty select group in this part of the world compared to these days where every second person on social media seems to be putting themselves out there as an online coach. But yeah, the market was a lot smaller then, and it's a little bit more competitive now, let's say.
But things snowballed, and obviously you're doing a terrific job now. It has been a very successful 12 years for you. But I'm intrigued, in your early years of coaching, what you learned, the kind of messages you were putting out to athletes, have they stayed the same 12 years on, or have they changed? Have you changed quite a lot as a coach?
Yeah, I probably have. I guess when I started out coaching, even with club runners and guys running sort of 3 hours, 3.5 hours for the marathon, what I'd done with everybody, my model of operating at the time was meet them, do a lactate test with them, and then base a lot of their training, all of their training on like sort of paces and heart rates that we got from the lactate test. So we used to do, I'd meet them at a track, we'd do sort of a step test, like maybe 5 by a mile or 5 by 5 minutes on the track, take some lactates, gauge where their heart rates were, and program the training off that. And even though these were, I know, compared to the elite standard of athletes that I'm coaching at these days, they were much slower, but I learned a huge amount off them, and I'd have them check in every week and we'd look at their paces and their heart rates, and they'd upload their data to Strava or Garmin Connect or whatever it might be. And I learned a huge amount from coaching athletes at that level because I took a scientific approach to it straight away. And I guess in my early years from chatting to various different coaches, and I would have had a big emphasis on threshold because I would have, you know, done the lactate testing, and threshold would have been the backbone of what we've done. And I still think it is the backbone of my sort of training philosophy. But I guess over the last couple of years, I'd have probably changed a little bit in that, realizing that particularly for higher level athletes, that balance of, you know, a good aerobic side has to be balanced out with a very measured approach to the anaerobic side of training as well. So I guess you're always learning. But I think the key from any coach in perspective is that you're listening to the athletes, taking their feedback on board. And then you end up, you've got a philosophy, but you've got to individualize the training for each person as well. And using science as much as you can.
So this would have been, you were taking recreational runners even sort of 2015, 2016 and getting them lactate tested.
Yeah. So I was going to the track, meeting them. We'd establish kind of where their base level of fitness were. We'd do maybe five or six, say 5 minute intervals, starting from very low level and finishing, you know, at a sort of an all out max effort at the end, and just gauging where those thresholds were, pinpointing the paces and heart rates where their lactate was beginning to rise, and then basing the training around that. And I think just as a general observation of athletes, I think one of the key things for any runner, and particularly young runners who've got ambition of going on to compete at international level, is learning how to run threshold is really important. And I think it's something that a lot of younger athletes miss, is that they think by smashing sessions every week that you get long-term progression. And obviously you do get long-term, you do get progress from training hard from time to time. If there was one message I could give to up and coming athletes, is it's learn how to run threshold, learn what that sort of 2 millimole work feels like. Even if you didn't have a heart rate monitor, if you didn't have a lactate analyzer, or if you didn't have your Garmin watch, that you've got a good gauge of what that feels like. And that, you know, when you come to senior level, it becomes really important, because we spend, you know, a lot of time on camp. We do 3 or 4 altitude camps a year. And when you go to places like, say, we were in Fontremont in October, and you go to the track, everybody's there doing threshold or doing double threshold. It's all really well measured and gauged, and they're accumulating big volumes of threshold, but they understand what sort of 2 millimole work feels like, or what 4 millimole work feels like. And I think it's a really important skill for athletes to learn. And, you know, that sort of threshold or double threshold type model is the backbone of most middle and long distance athletes at an international level now.
Agree with that. I don't want to talk too much about the recreational runners, but do they respond to that threshold as well as an elite would? Because I've always looked at sort of double threshold and thought you kind of need to be at a level to even try to adopt that style of training.
Yeah, I wouldn't be prescribing double threshold for anybody probably running less than 75, 80 miles per week. I think if your mileage is less than that, you've got a lot of other scope of adding in, you know, for recreational or club runners, say adding in double days, maybe single threshold workouts that are kind of slightly bigger volume. But in terms of the progress, what I found with club runners is that very often their perception of effort and where their paces were compared to where their training times were miles apart. And by doing the lactate testing, they got a much better gauge for what sort of pace they should be training at on a day-to-day basis. I think when you talk about elite runners, they've got a much better gauge of where their paces should be. A lot of club runners just go out and they smash workouts 2 or 3 times a week. Their easy runs are probably too hard. I would say 90% of club runners that I've worked with have got success on the back of slowing down and just learning to run their easy days easy, run their threshold days specific. And then there obviously are hard days in there as well, but getting a feel for what those various different intensities should look like, that's probably where I got most progress from them. And I learned a huge amount of coaching those club and recreational runners over those first few years.
It's just time with athletes, right? And coaching at the end 100%. Of the day is...
And listening to them.
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, coaching is the people business at the end of the day. It's that art of communication and being able to understand them and looking at an athlete and going, this is what they need. I think that's a very, very difficult skill.
Yeah, I think listening to the athlete is probably the most important part of all of that, because if you're genuinely analysing what somebody's done for the week, taking their feedback on board, making a couple of tweaks to the next few weeks, then you're learning and they're progressing. And that happens slowly over time. You know, with endurance running, nothing happens quickly, nothing happens overnight. But if you can, like, ultimately, what that's allowing you to do is stay consistent, is that you can stack week on top of week, month on top of month. And if you look at athletes who make a breakthrough, generally it comes on the back of 2 or 3 years of largely uninterrupted training. And I think if you look at most guys who have been, you know, very competitive at world level, you look back at what they've done for the last 2 or 3 years, the most important thing that they've done is not get injured. So your whole training model is built around the fact that you can just keep coming back day after day. And then go back to, you know, even looking at the likes of, you know, say Tokyo World Championships, you look at the likes of Almgren and Jimmy Gressier and guys like that had stellar performances there. That's come on the back of 2 or 3 years of largely uninterrupted training. They're obviously doing big volume. They're hugely talented athletes. But if you're picking up niggles and setbacks along the way, then it's very hard to make that progress. And I think, yeah, when you analyze most of the really good athletes, is the first thing I'd look at is, have they had 2 or 3 years of uninterrupted training? And that's generally what you tend to see.
That's almost the number one goal when you're looking to take someone to that next level.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's, can you stack 2 or 3 years back to back and not get, yeah, avoid those little pitfalls and interruptions along the way.
Emmett, before we get into the nuts and bolts, let's just discuss your athlete pool. Who are you currently working with?
Yeah, so here in Ireland, I work with, I suppose it's sort of higher profile athletes would be, like I said, Darren McElhenney, Jack O'Leary on the men's side, Danielle Donegan, Amory McGlynn on the women's side, and we've a lot of other guys, you know, around that as well. And there'd be sort of the higher profile names. And then I suppose since this is a UK podcast, they're probably familiar with Charlie and George Wheeler. So I've just started working with them during the summer as well. Yeah, really excited to see what we can do with them because the lads have, I think, huge potential. And yeah, it's just beginning. I mean, Charlie ran his first race last week in Valencia, which I think you covered in your Valencia recap last week. So things got off to a good start. So looking forward to see where we can take them over the next couple of years.
What's the challenges of taking on new talent like the Wheelers? They're already at an extremely high level. How do you get them into that system as quick as possible? Were there any challenges you found early on, or was it a pretty easy transition?
Yeah, like we're still in the early stages. So, I mean, the biggest thing for me is building a relationship with the lads. So they came to Fontremoe when we were up there with the Irish squad in October. And it was great because you got to spend a week or 10 days with them, see them every day, you know, go for a coffee the odd day and just chat to the training. And I suppose trying to explain to them what we're trying to achieve over the next while. I think the biggest challenge with Charlie and George, and I'm sure they'll probably laugh when they listen to this, is they like training hard. And I'm probably coming at things from the opposite end of the spectrum, where I'm trying to put a little bit of control with lactates and heart rates. The lads very much run off field. They like to go out, they like to train hard, they like to run hard, which has yielded a lot of really good results. But I think if they're going to long-term progression in the sport and really fully realize their potential, putting a little bit more structure on what they're doing, a little bit more control on it, and not just thinking towards the next race, but thinking out to sort of, you know, where do I want to be in 6 months' time, 12 months' time, or 2 or 3 years' time in terms of making major championships. So, I think the biggest challenge with any new athlete is building the relationship. But the guys that are here in Dublin, I see them 2 or 3 times a week. It's great. You build that rapport over time. So it just takes time and try and get as much exposure to the athletes as possible. So hopefully we'll get the lads on a few more camps with us over the coming year as well.
Absolutely. This threshold formula, has it ever been unsuccessful? Because we always hear about how amazing it is, how great it is. You know, you train with such precision, it might take a while, but there's success, it's sustainable, it keeps you injury free. But have you ever found a time where it actually hasn't worked like you hoped it would? And have you ever drifted away from it at different periods?
Yeah, I definitely had athletes. I think particularly middle distance and say 1500 meter athletes, if you go too far down the threshold road, it ends up, okay, they get very aerobically strong, but it blunts your anaerobic system. That is one of your primary tools if you're trying to race middle distance. So, I've had a few examples of this over the years and I've probably learned the hard way where I've got an athlete very aerobically fit over the course of the winter, but come the early part of the summer, it's really taken them a while to get going because we haven't done enough sharper work coming into the season. And I suppose with an example over the last 2 years, Dara McElhenney, most people listening might be familiar with Dara. So obviously Dara in 2022 would have been, a contender at the European Outdoor 5K Champs. He was fourth in Istanbul in the world, European Indoors. And then a lot of people would have felt that he's disappeared for the next year and a half. Now he picked up a virus, had a couple of issues in terms of the health side of things, but we were really struggling with getting him back to form once he got healthy. And one of the biggest issues with that is we started working with a Belgian physiologist called Jan Albrecht. And when we'd done some testing with Jan, he pinpointed that Dara was very well developed on the aerobic side, so from all the threshold stuff we'd done, but he felt that the anaerobic side had been very much blunted by the fact that probably a combination of the illness and possibly also the fact that maybe we just got the balance slightly wrong in terms of aerobic to anaerobic. So maybe doing too much threshold. It's always hard to know exactly, but ultimately Jan's advice was that we needed to kind of flip the stimulus park the threshold stuff for a period of time and really focus on a shorter, faster work. So what he would call VLA max work. So the VLA max is like it's a reflection of your anaerobic capacity effectively. So this time last year, we completely flipped the stimulus, completely changed Dara's training, brought his mileage down probably about to 2/3 of what it normally is. So he'd normally be a 100-mile-a-week guy. We brought him down to sort of 60 to 70 mile a week, which was a big step. And then took all of the threshold out, and his workouts were just stuff like we go to the track twice a week and maybe do something like 6 to 8 by 200 meters of a 90-second recovery, just as hard as you could, try and produce as much lactate as possible and prime that anaerobic system. So that might be a session early in the week. And then the second one would be something like maybe 200 meters hard, kilometer float, and maybe like 340, and just doing 6 of that. And I suppose that's very different type of training from what your typical middle distance runner would do. And it was a bit of a leap of faith as well, because Jan was kind of guiding us in terms of what we needed to do. I was looking at this going, this is like very crazy, atypical for a middle distance runner at international level. And it was tough. Like we had a sort of a 10 or 12 weeks in total where we went through that. And eventually at the end of that, we'd done another retest. We'd done a test halfway through and nothing had changed, because basically I was trying to do half and half. I was trying to do a little bit of threshold and some of the anaerobic stuff. We're back to Jan. He basically said, look, you need to go 100%. You need to commit all into this if you're going to change stuff. So we did for the next 8 weeks. We just went all in and retested the week before Christmas. And it was like the best Christmas present ever, that everything had come back to where we needed it. And basically, Jan gave us the green light to resume training as normal. And I suppose to give you an idea, middle of that block, Dara raced a 3K in Dublin indoors, ran 7:58, 7:59. And that was flat to the boards. And that was like really, really hard. And then once we went back to normal training, after 6 weeks, he ran 7:42 in Boston. And that was a race where he got clipped on the last lap. He probably would have ran 7:38, 7:39 that day had he not fallen. And he felt so much better. And since then, I suppose the lesson that I've taken away from that is that we need to be very conscious of the balance of aerobic to anaerobic in training. So at least once every 2 weeks now, we'll get Dara to do maybe a set of hills or something short and fast that... The goal is not to stay at a certain level of lactate. The goal is to produce as much lactate as possible, produce a load of power, and ultimately prime that anaerobic system. So it was a big learning for me. And just, you know, your question early on is, you know, have my philosophy changed? I would think in the last 12 months, my philosophy has changed enormously, and that I'm a lot more conscious of periodization. And also at certain times of the year when, you know, if you feel an athlete needs a new stimulus, that you go at it 100%, you really commit to it, that you don't just try and do a little bit of this and try and do, you know, a little bit of aerobic, a little bit of anaerobic. If they need something, go at it 100%, dedicate a period of maybe 2 or 3 months to that. And that means parking your racing season. It means it might be sacrificing races or championships along the way, but ultimately it's looking at it from a more long-term perspective. Because I guess the conversation that I had with Dara this time last year is when we were in the middle of this, is that we looked at it as if, you know, this was the beginning of a 4-year cycle to the next Olympics. And maybe we tried this and it didn't work, but it was probably worth the sacrifice of 3 or 4 months of a 4-year block. And if it didn't work, it didn't work. As it turned out, it's worked really well. And anyone who's followed Dara during the summer has seen he did, you know, great summer, ran 13:02 and just missed out in the World Championship final. So we're in a much happier place with our conversations this autumn to where we were last autumn, I'd have to say.
100%. I mean, that is a very, very aggressive change. Like you said, you really did have to go in on that to drop his mileage by that amount to really, you know, 6200s to a guy like Dara would just be alien. And you're doing it at a time in the year where everyone's like, right, let's start building on that aerobic engine. Let's, you know, everyone's going on these altitude camps to build strength, whereas you were still looking to really develop his ability to produce lactate, right? That's essentially what VLA max is, right? Your rate at your ability to produce lactate.
Yeah, it's the rate at which you produce lactate per minute.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, I guess you'd have gone back to what I've learned from
nothing. For Dara, that was very, very low. He could hardly produce it.
It was low for somebody who wanted to be competitive as an international athlete over middle distance. So if you wanted to be a marathon runner, as you go through your career, that VLA max or that anaerobic capacity, it gets dampened down, because ultimately that's what you need if you want to be a good marathon runner. you need to be less developed on the anaerobic side and obviously a big aerobic engine. But if you want to be competitive at middle distance, you need a balance in both. And obviously depending on how short, like if you were an 800 meter runner, that balance needs to be a lot more fine tuned again. But it's finding, you know, where that balance is for the individual, but also for the event that you're targeting. Yeah, I mean, like you said, 6x200 for an athlete who was going to the track to do maybe a 40 or 45 minute threshold session. The whole thing was done and dusted in, you know, you had 6x200 in less than 30 seconds, 90 second recovery in between, 12 minutes, you were done. And that was it for the day. And I think that was really challenging.
He must have struggled as an athlete to get his head around that. And when did he start to believe that you were doing the right thing?
It probably wasn't until mid-January. So we got the positive test result before Christmas. So Jan said, okay, green lights, everything is where it needs to be to start resuming threshold training. And within probably 2 to 3 weeks, his threshold numbers were back to where they had been when he was in good shape, going back 2 years previous. And more importantly, he felt really good. He felt like the paces were coming easy to him. And certainly when we were in Dullstrom in mid-January last year, there was a sense that things had turned a corner and that he was back on track. And that turned out to be the case when he started racing as well. But I suppose it's important to pinpoint, to backtrack here, is like there was also a virus that he had prior to that. So he had been ill. So there's always a difficulty in pinpointing, you know, how much of this was down to training, how much of this was down to a health issue. But ultimately, the way that I'd look at physiology testing is it's like a diagnostics check. It's like getting your car plugged in to get a check to see, is there anything wrong? And I would look at physiology testing like that, as you kind of plug the athlete in, see where the physiology is at, and see, does anything need to be tweaked for the event that they're getting ready for and where they're at the minute. So like this, what I just outlined is not a quick fix for everybody. I've done the same approach with probably 2 or 3 other athletes over the course of the last year and had pretty successful results with it. But there's lots of other athletes, to say Jack O'Leary that I coach. Jack is a 13-20 man. And when we got Jack tested, the recommendations were anaerobic side is probably nearly overdeveloped. He needs to work on the aerobic side. So it's not like this is a quick fix for everybody. It depends on where your own individual physiology is at. So like Jack has never done anything like that sort of short, fast stuff. And you know, developed on his aerobic side, and he's at a, you know, really successful 2025 on the back of a very different approach.
Completely. I know Dara had the virus and stuff, but just last summer, 2024 that was, if we go back to the symptoms you were seeing in races and in training, which started to hint towards he is blunting that anaerobic end, what were they? Because I remember watching a few races and he would be sweet. And then lap to go, he would just implode.
He was not sweet.
Clearly he was, yeah. I guess if I was inside his body, he was not sweet, but yeah, he looked like he was.
Yeah, I mean, from chatting with Jan Albrecht a lot, his analysis of an athlete in that situation is that because your anaerobic system is blunted, when it gets to that point, 3/4 of the way through the race where lactate levels are high, you know, if you were to stop the athlete at 4K in a 5K, lactate levels are already really high. Because your anaerobic system is blunted or underdeveloped, you're not able to deal with that acidosis. And ultimately, you go from a situation where you're feeling reasonable, you know, feeling like you normally do at 4K and a 5K where you're working hard. But then that acidosis just takes over and the body just shuts down. And that's what Dara was feeling in races. He was getting to sort of 3K, 4K, feeling reasonable. But then everything just shut down very quickly because, and this would have been, you know, Albert's explanation is that acidosis kicked in and you come to a point where you can barely put one foot in front of the other because some of the implosions in the latter stages of some of his races were pretty spectacular. And it's funny because I suppose Jan would have explained the theory on this to me on some of the early calls. And it was like when he explained the theory, it was just like the perfect explanation of what was happening in some of Dara's races as well. So that was the first point where I thought, okay, maybe this could be the solution to the problem.
Just huge lessons there, because you obviously then do this aggressive period where you really work on that anaerobic end. But, you know, he was still, many people look at the 5,000 especially as being a strongman's event. You've got to have a huge, huge engine. But you were willing to sacrifice that pre-Christmas. Post-Christmas, you then start, you know, within 6 months, he was running 13.0, or within, you know, 7 months of going back to that strength stuff, he was then running 13.02, you know, his best ever in qualifying for the World Championship. So it didn't take him, a guy like Dara, it didn't take him that long to rebuild that strength up.
No, and even during that period where he wasn't running well, like a lot of the time he was still running sort of around about 100 mile a week. So it's not like he'd been sick or injured and not unable to run completely. So I think a lot of that aerobic side, that big engine was still there. It was just the fine tuning and the balance bit that had gone out of balance. And ultimately we needed to correct that balance. So once the anaerobic side was corrected, we'd done that fairly aggressive period of VLA max work. Yeah, within a couple of weeks, really, once he was back to top form straight away, but within sort of 6 to 8 weeks, he was feeling good and running well, you know, as in like sort of around that 7:40 mark for 3K. And certainly then as the year went on, there's also an element, you know, if an athlete doesn't race at a high level for a year and a half, you can't just expect to come straight in at the very top again. There's a period where you just got to get used to racing, get used to the intensity of racing, and just your body needs to gradually, you know, progress on the back of consecutive races as well. And yeah, during the summer, that was evident because, you know, he started off pretty well, running 13:16 early in the summer. And then gradually as the summer went on with extra races, a bit more race specific stuff, that got down to 13:02 by the time we got to Ordegem in Belgium, which was what, that was early August. So it was a normal season, which was great considering the couple of years that we had prior to that.
It was a terrific turnaround. Terrific turnaround. You've obviously mentioned Jan Albrecht quite a bit. Do you want to just give a little bit of context to him, Belgian physiologist? And when you're, I think one of the biggest challenges as a coach is understanding what an athlete needs. Now, you're obviously testing your athletes regularly. Do you think you do have the ability to also eyeball it, and you're starting to gain the knowledge now to understand what athletes need without having to put them in the lab? Or would you always swear by getting athletes in the lab and testing them?
Yeah, we actually do most of our testing outdoors. So I do it as part of training rather than, so they get in on the treadmill, maybe in the lab, maybe once a year. Probably Dara hasn't been indoors in a test probably in maybe 2 years, but generally I like to say maybe at least once a year we go inside and do some testing. But just to take a step back, in terms, if people aren't familiar with Jan Albrecht, he was one of the pioneers behind the revolution in Dutch swimming in the sort of late 90s, early 2000s. And he took, he's a physiologist from Belgium, but he would have very much a heavy physiology approach to all sports. But particularly, I think swimming is probably where he made his initial gains. And since then he works with athletes across all sorts of levels. He would have worked with Wout van Aert, the cyclist. People might be familiar with him. He still works with a lot of cyclists. He's worked with quite a few of the Belgian distance runners as well. Isaac Comelli, guys like that. Some people will be familiar with them. But he works across all sports. And if you're looking to read up a little bit more, people will probably be Googling. He doesn't have much of a presence online. He's a fairly reserved character, but he has a very good book. It's an old one. It's called The Science of Winning. And it's based around swimming. It's a very heavy read. It's very heavy physiology wise. But if people want to learn a little bit more about his approach, that would be the best way to go about it. And I just got in touch with him because ultimately you're talking about eyeball and stuff. I think, as I've learned over the years, I think it's very hard to eyeball an athlete in terms of their threshold and their real requirements. I think you need to be testing in the field or testing in the lab. How regularly, I don't know, maybe once or twice a year to really get a feel for what's going on at a physiological level. And sometimes that's a case of the problem has already occurred and you've got to go back and correct it, as was the case that I just outlined there. And sometimes it's a case of, you know, the balance has gone a little bit out of kilter and we just need to, it's more like preventative measures that we need to do a little bit more speed work, do a little bit more aerobic work. But I guess my experience over the years is 90% of athletes need more aerobic work rather than anaerobic stuff. So I know what I just outlined sounds like it's a pretty novel approach, but that's very much the minority. The majority of athletes probably need to work on the aerobic side. And in terms of developing that aerobic side, I think a lot of people tend to think that they have a feel for what threshold is. I think if you're not testing with lactates fairly reasonably regularly, I think sometimes people get that wrong. They think what might be a threshold session, even though they feel quite comfortable, it mightn't be reflected in what the lactate numbers are at. So that's what I might say most Tuesday nights when we go to training, we do sort of a threshold session on a Tuesday night for the wider group. I bring the lactate monitors down and I just kind of spot check people during the session. And more often than not, you're telling them to slow down rather than to speed up.
Which is a hard concept to wrap your head around.
It is, especially because everybody likes working hard. Everybody likes going to training on a Tuesday night or Saturday morning and hitting the workout hard. And there's a feel-good factor to that, whereas I think a lot of the sustained progress comes from taking a little bit more measured and controlled approach to it. And if you look at international level, the likes of the double threshold, which is, you know, pretty well established at this stage as being one of the, it's the backbone of a lot of international middle distance runners training week. Like, that's a very controlled session. You accumulate a lot of volume during the day. I mean, they could be 20, 22 miles for a lot of senior athletes accumulated over a double threshold day, but it's a lot of it is really controlled. And if you're not controlling it, that combination of high volume and intensity that's too high is just a recipe for injury.
Yeah, absolutely. We've spoken a lot about the physiology, but a large part of our sport is the psychology as well. Mm-hmm. How do you manage, or how do you develop athletes' confidence? Because I always see athletes' confidence as one of the hardest things. I look at it and like it just has to be earned. Really, the athlete's confidence has to be earned through the training, through the preparation of a race. And how do you develop that as a coach?
I think from my point of view, I mean, the psychology, there's certain times where you need to seek external help in these situations. And as a coach, it always being in of the mindset that you know, whatever the problem, be it psychological, physical, you need to be willing to look for help and look for, you know, people who are the best in their field to help you with any particular problem. But, you know, when it comes to, I suppose, psychology on a sort of a confidence basis, I think an awful lot of that comes from sitting down at the beginning of the season, planning out your year, knowing what your target races are, having realistic goals in place in terms of what you want to achieve over the next 6 months, 12 months, or maybe 4 years. And then monitoring the training in such a way that you can say, right, what you've done this week is, you know, a certain percentage better than what you'd done 3 months ago or 6 months ago. And I think the athlete gets confidence from that, and they can see my paces are better, heart rates are better, lactates are better. I think true confidence comes from that, because a coach telling you that you're in great shape is fine, and telling you go out and you know, take the race by the scruff of the neck and get stuck in, that's all fine. But in order to truly believe it, I think you've got to see the measurements and the data from training. And then if you have that, that gives the athlete confidence going in on race day. And then you obviously want to see race results on the back of that as well, because training data is not worth anything unless you're racing well. But for me, a lot of the confidence for athletes comes from the fact that they're doing sessions that they have data to compare to. They've got heart rates, paces and lactates that they've done maybe 12 months previous. I'm in better shape now. I know I'm in better shape now. And that's going to give me the confidence to go in and race well on the back of that.
Absolutely. Have you found it hard to build confidence in sort of recreational runners, the ones you work with on that level? Because I always think one of the biggest difference between sort of elites or sub-elites and recreational runners is recreational runners are really, they have a lot of self-doubt. They're really humble. They'll do these amazing sessions and they won't really understand what these sessions mean in terms of a race. And they'll be quick to be like, oh, I don't know if I can hold that pace. And when they've literally done a session which proves they can hold that pace and some.
Yeah. Do you know what? With club runners, I find they're nearly overconfident, because they tend to go out and do an awful lot of workouts at paces that I know that they can't sustain from say previous race results or physiology testing. And then they beat themselves up because let's say you go out and you're trying to run reps at 5:30, 6 minutes a mile, right? And you go out and you're running those reps too fast, and they start at 5:30, but they end up at 6 minutes a mile or 6:10 per mile. So the session gets progressively slower as you go along. Like that, then the athlete comes back, you know, struggling confidence wise because they think, right, I've gone out at 5:30s, I've ended up slowing as the session went on. You know, I'm not in shape. But when the reality is, the 5:30 at the start was just too quick. And having taken that more progressive approach to the session where you start at, right, and this is where the sort of the testing and knowing where your threshold paces are at or where your race paces are at is starting at an appropriate level for where your current fitness is. You know, train to where you are right now as opposed to where you want to be in 3 months' time or 6 months' time. And even with, say, we've run quite a few online programs, and a double marathon 2 weeks ago would have been like a really busy time of the year for our online groups. And a lot of them would run double marathon. But the big thing, like all of them don't have physiology testing done. They're not all in a lab 2 or 3 times a year. But what I do is I take their most recent race performance and we have a chart and basically say, like, if this is what you've done for a half marathon, this is more than likely what you're going to be able to do for a full marathon. Mm-hmm. And then you train at those paces as opposed to people picking, say, a round number and say, I want to break 3 hours or I want to break 3:30, is that there's a little bit more thought put into it. And I think for recreational runners is having a little bit more thought around where their current fitness is at and training to that as opposed to, you know, where I want to be on race day in 6 months' time. It's probably, you know, that tends to yield pretty good results over the longer term.
That training where you are now, not where you want to be, does that transfer over to the elites as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. So when guys come back at the beginning of the season, they've taken their break at the end of August after their track season. They've lost a bit of fitness. You know, they're just not as sharp as they were in summertime. They need to train to where that new fitness is in September, as opposed to where they want to be for National Cross in November or Eurocross in December. So it can be quite humbling in the early stages, but ultimately you will get more sustained sort of medium to long-term progress off that approach. Whereas if you go up and you start smashing sessions in September, there's a quick return off that, but it tapers off very quickly and there's a much higher risk in terms of getting injured. Whereas if you're willing to take that longer-term approach, the peak will be higher and the risk of picking up injuries and niggles is that little bit less as well, because you're training to an appropriate level of intensity for where your body is currently at.
World Championships in Tokyo. I think you phrased it as dining at the top table, which I thought was a lovely way to put it. Was Dara your first athlete at a major championship, major outdoor global championships?
Yeah. So a marathon runner I coach, Anne-Marie McGlynn, missed the Tokyo Olympics by 4 seconds in the marathon during COVID, which was probably one of the biggest disappointments I've ever seen within the sport, because Anne-Marie was in her early 40s at the time and this was last chance saloon. So yeah. Dara was the first time we've had a success for
both of you. Big achievement for both of you. What were your biggest takeaways from Tokyo and being at the World Championships in that environment?
My biggest takeaway from Tokyo was it gave me enormous confidence and motivation for European athletes to be really, truly competitive at global level again. Because, I mean, I've been around the sport for 30 years. I mean, if you've watched athletics through the 90s and 2000s and 2010s, 5K, 10K and marathon was just the preserve of the East Africans. They were untouchable, like particularly in stuff like the events like the 10K. You just couldn't get close to it. Even making a final was almost impossible. I remember World Cross was in Kenya. Was it in Mombasa? In 2000, maybe around 2007, 2008. I think there might have been, you know, one European athlete in the top 50. We had got so far away from being competitive at a global stage. It was mind-boggling. And Tokyo was just the antithesis of that. The men's 10K was one of the first events early in the championship. And I thought, Grecia winning, Almgren being third, and loads of, you know, Americans and Europeans, you know, lads in our training group can relate to being competitive and winning medals, I thought was just so motivational. You know, Jordy Beamish winning the steeplechase as well. For me, that was the big takeaway from Tokyo, is that European athletes, male and female, can go there and be competitive at a global level again. And it's not that we're, you know, 10, 15 seconds behind or just, you know, struggling to make a final. They can go there and actually be competitive. So like, that was the big takeaway. But like a global champs, like, it was a brilliant championships as well. It was great going into an 80,000 seater stadium every night and it was pretty much full to capacity. Some great races. Were you there?
I was there for the men's 1500 final. So I watched that. Okay, I was there for just a couple of days, I didn't get to enjoy the whole week, unfortunately.
Yeah, so like it was a brilliant championships and it's great to have a world championship. Like the atmosphere, as you've probably seen, like the atmosphere around it was great. It's in a country that appreciates athletics, and I think that's really important, is that we need to be having these championships in places where you're going to have a full stadium and where there's a knowledgeable crowd, and the Japanese definitely ticked all those boxes. It was brilliant. And there were some super races on the back of it as well.
It really were. I've got to ask, Dan, it's a question that we always talk about, debate we always have, but why have the Europeans been able to surpass the Africans? Like you say, you talk about that men's 10K. There seemed to be a lot more Europeans or Americans featuring in that 10K towards the pointy end, steeple, etc., 1500. Why have we surpassed the Africans on the track?
I think if you look back over the last 15 to 20 years, there was a stage in the sort of early 2000s where a lot of American, European, to the Western countries had got away from high volume training. It was this idea that maybe sort of lower volume but higher quality was going to get you there quicker. And that was found out to be just wasn't the case. And I think one of the biggest changes we've seen over the last few years is a return to high volume training. And then I think combine that with the threshold element to it. I think the science has got a lot more specific. Everything is a lot more measured. That has just brought the, you know, not even looking at where the Africans have gone, just looking at the European level and American level, it's just gone through the roof. Like guys are running 13 minutes, 12:50 for 5K. On the women's side, there's loads of people breaking 15 minutes and running sort of 31s and 30s and beyond. There's just that, you know, that massive improvement on the back of high volume and better, I think a better science approach to it. And I think, you know, if you're to be honest about it, there's probably an element with the Africans as well. It's given all of the doping scandals that we've seen that's probably having an impact in terms of their their competitiveness. I mean, it's hard to get away from the fact that what we've got about 140, 150 Kenyans on the banned list at the minute. You have to think that that's having some sort of an impact in terms of their approach. And you know, there's a whole lot of different aspects to that. But I think that's part of the equation as well. And I guess, you know, when you look at that sort of doping side of things, it can be very frustrating, and you can't get too caught up in it as an athlete or a coach and thinking that, you know, everybody you're lining up against is taking stuff. Because the one takeaway that I have from this summer is that clean athletes can get to a very, very high level over the, you know, at global level. And I talked about Dara, Cian McPhillips, who finished fourth in the 800. Cian I'd be very good friends with Cian's coach, Joe Ryan, and they would train with us and we would train with them. We'd link in with groups from time to time. I mean, I know what these guys are doing, and I know the level that he's been able to get to. And that's, you know, very reassuring and very, it's just a great confidence boost that you know you can get to the top table of world athletics clean. And I think sometimes people look at times being run and they think, oh, everybody must be taking stuff at that level. They're not. They're taking a very measured long-term approach to it a lot of the time. There are people who will always take shortcuts. But like I said, you can't get caught up worrying about that, because you'd spend all your energy and all your time getting concerned with everybody else rather than focusing on making yourself faster, which is ultimately the most important part of it.
You really would. We are becoming a lot more accepting of more volume, right? At the elite level, especially, that's now starting to trickle down into sub-elite level and the junior ranks as well. And none other than Ava, how do you pronounce Ava's name? Ava Crean? The 19-year-old runs the Dublin Marathon, 2:34, 19 years old, and we're now starting to see, you know, sort of those teenagers really take to, you know, there's far more 16, 17-year-olds who have run a 10K than ever before. You know, usually we're at 16, the furthest you could run used to be able to run was 3,000 meters. Now you can do a park run. You're getting a taste for 5K. A lot of them are now doing 10Ks. So there is this shift towards this acceptance for young athletes to do long distance events now.
There is. I still think it needs to be quite measured with younger athletes. The professor down in Limerick here in Ireland, a guy called Phil Kearney, and he'd done a really good analysis on the power of 10 rankings, your UK rankings a couple of years back, and he'd done a lovely paper on it. And just looked at, I think what he'd done is he looked at the senior UK or GB internationals and see where did they feature on the rankings at younger age groups, at sort of under 19, under 17, under 15 and under 13. And one of the key takeaways from that was that what you do at under 13 and under 15 level is not really relevant to what you do as a senior athlete. And in fact, being very successful at 13, 14 or 15 is probably more of a negative than a positive for if you want to become to go on and become a fully fledged senior international. So I think the takeaway from that point I'm trying to make is that, like, you need to be very careful with volume and hard training in those younger teenage years. But then when you get to sort of 16, 17, again, that study would have shown that those athletes who became GB internationals very much become more prominent from 16, 17 years of age onwards in terms of the rankings. They're featuring a lot more prominently. And that's something you would expect. But I would say, looking at a lot of our Irish senior internationals now, there are exceptions to this, but an awful lot of them only really began to come to prominence in their late teens as opposed to being a child prodigy at 12 or 13. And I think that's something to keep in mind, is that you've got younger kids when they come into the sport, it's keeping them involved, learning the skills, but not piling on too much hard training too soon. One of the again, going back to Jan Albrecht, one of his great phrases when it came to juvenile training is not too much and not too soon. So whereas I believe definitely a high volume level or high volume model is important if you want to be competitive at senior level, you've got to get there gradually and not do too much too soon. And I guess with you know, the likes of Ava running 2:34 for the marathon last week, Ava's only 19. She's clearly got a big engine. She's got a huge amount of talent and ability. I'd really like to see her go back to some of the shorter distances now and hone those skills over 5K, 10K, maybe even 1500 metres. And park the marathon for a while. That would be what I'd like to see happen. You know, sometimes when an athlete puts in a big performance as a juvenile, it can be more of a hindrance than a positive, because it creates a lot of expectation around it. So it's just got to be managed carefully.
Yeah, I was wondering how that performance would have been received in Ireland. I know she was front page of all the papers because she won the overall marathon didn't she? She won the female category.
She did. Yeah, because Anne-Marie McGlynn that I mentioned earlier, Anne-Marie was second. And talk about a contrast. Anne-Marie is, she won't mind me saying, is 45, and Ava was 19. There was a bit of an age gap there, to put it mildly. But yeah, I mean, it, And that's, I guess, with all of these things. And I've seen, we've seen this over the years with, you know, 12-year-olds running a park run world record or 14-year-olds running a 5K world record. I just think that sort of stuff shouldn't really be getting coverage because it's generally, it's putting way too much expectation on the athlete at a very young age. And very often, whatever you do at 12 or 13 or 14 years of age is, it's just natural ability. And it's, you know, can that talent, which is clearly talent, be translated up to senior level? I don't get excited about, you know, kids under 14, under 15, under 16 running well. I look at that and go, it's great. There's clearly a lot of ability there, but can we transfer it up to under 23 and senior level? I think that's much more important. It's not getting carried away with that, those underage performances too much.
Is there an argument to say that if you are going to be 20, 21 years of age and trying to run 80, 90 mile a week, that you have got to have some development when you're sort of 15, 16, and you've got to be slowly getting used to that type of volume? Looking at like the Ingebrigtsen model, right? You know, what he was doing at 15, 16, or even the Kenyans, you know, it's well documented. They run, you know, 10K to school and back at the age of 14, 15.
Yeah. I think if you're a good 15, 16-year-old and you're running, I don't know, maybe 40 mile a week, which is, you know, probably killed quite a bit for a kid at that age, but you've got to look at it over the next sort of 8 years or 10 years, you know, and just aim to add maybe 5 to 10 miles per week onto that total over the space of a long period of time. And I think, say, when Dara came to Dublin first, he was running about maybe sort of 65-70 mile a week, and the first thing we'd done was kind of laid out a plan in terms of what your volume change needs to look like over each year. And I think if you're 16 and you're at a certain level, plan it out over 8 years, that by the time you get to 24, that you're at 100 mile a week, give or take, and do that in a gradual manner. I think obviously the Ingebrigtsens it's a prime example, and it's one that will grab a lot of headlines and it's got a lot of coverage over the years. But I think Jakob is probably, all the Ingebrigtsens, they're probably the exception rather than the rule, that there's been a lot of hard training. They've obviously been really successful on the back of that. I don't know if I'd be recommending that model for everybody. That would be my own personal preference.
I think there'll be question marks. Yeah, there'll be question marks over his longevity as well. Now, obviously, he had this season out, and if he continues like his brothers to get consistently injured, then all he's done is he's become an amazing athlete at the age of 23, 24, as opposed to an amazing athlete at the age of 28, 29.
Yeah. And my argument in that situation would be, you're always likely to be better if you can be patient and wait till you're 28, 29, because you're a bit more mature and you're a bit stronger as well. But it's interesting because I've chatted to a few of the Norwegian coaches over the last year or so. I've met them on camps and stuff, and they're taking that high volume approach with a lot of their younger athletes now. So it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out over the next couple of years. Does Norway become dominant force at international athletics? Because like, they're bringing in double threshold for, you know, kids in their sort of teens, sort of 14, 15 years of age. Now, obviously at a lower level, lower volume and stuff like that, and it's been measured and managed fairly carefully, but it'll be very interesting to see how that translates over the next sort of 4 or 5 years to see a conveyor belt of Ingebrigtsens coming through.
The sport is just professionalizing across the board, isn't it? You know, from youngsters all the way up to the elites. And it really is just accelerating in so many ways. And I think one way in Ireland it's accelerating is you as a coach, and the coaches in Ireland are getting more funding, right? I read just recently, you guys are getting $150,000 a year for the next 4 years, obviously split up between various
it's not 150,000 each, just in case anybody misheard. Yeah, so Athletics Ireland and Sport Ireland have started funding coaches over the last couple of years. It started off pretty small, but it's not to start. I think it needs to go quite a bit further in terms of professionalising the coaches. But I think what we've got in Ireland at the minute is we've got a really good group of coaches, like, say, Mark Kirk, who's Nick Griggs's coach, Joe Ryan that I mentioned earlier. There's loads of coaches who are, and we're working together. So we regularly get together for sessions. We go on camps together. And all of this is beginning to come together under what's the National Endurance Group. So Mark Keneally has taken over as the National Endurance Coordinator. And one of the things he's done is set up a National Endurance Group. So basically, if you're at a certain standard, so we've got standards in place for Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3. Tier 1 is basically global level. Tier 2 is, you know, competitive at European level. Tier 3 is like guys who are probably on the borderline of making Eurocross. All of those guys, they have various different access to the Sport Ireland facilities in terms of physiology and medical backup and stuff like that. But I think one of the most important things is that we have 3 camps per year. So we had one in Font earlier in last month in October. We'll have another one in January, and we'll have another one in April. And I think getting all of the athletes and coaches together in those camps, working together and everybody pulling in the same direction, it's really raised the standards, because for a small country, we're doing pretty well at the moment. And if you look at the results from our middle distance guys in Tokyo, even, I mean, our marathon runners, Finola McCormick was top 10, and Peter Lynch had a really good performance in the marathon. And then on the track, you know, Andrew Cosgrove making a final. Sarah Healy's obviously been making waves over the last couple of years. Sophie O'Sullivan made a semi-final as well. And yeah, it's great to go to global champs and have people progressing through rounds and making finals. And I think that's a reflection of what's happening at a sort of a step back between coaching and coach funding. And yeah, and people, you know, working together makes a big difference.
Yeah, I feel like that system, Ireland are probably in that sweet spot. Your country is, no disrespect, just it's almost like a perfect size. You haven't got many coaches and so many athletes dotted all over the place that when you go on these camps, you can actually bring everyone together and it not be just loads of butting heads.
Yeah, and like, it's not perfect either, because like with any federation or actually National Athletic Association, it's not without its faults and it's not without stuff that we could be doing better. But generally speaking, I think you're right. I think we're a nice size where it's a relatively small running community. And if you've got a handful of coaches who are willing to work together, and they tend to have, you know, a lot of the good athletes in the country with them, that you can get them together for sessions, get them together for camps. And that sort of group environment makes a big difference. Like, if you look at it, it's probably sort of a watered down version of the model that really works at international level. Like a lot of the groups, the likes of the On Group, you know, New Balance groups, the various, you know, different shoe company backed groups around the world. I think that group model works really well. And I suppose what we've done in Ireland is kind of, we're doing that through the National Federation as opposed to having a backing from any particular shoe company on it. So at the moment, it's working really well. Like I said, there's plenty of things we could be doing a bit better, but they're being worked on. And the results are shown. And, you know, Eurocross is coming up now. So hopefully we'll have some more good results from that in a couple of weeks' time.
And then just on the Eurocross, before we finish up, what about the impact that the Eurocross had when it came to Dublin? Because that was obviously an amazing Eurocross. Irish athletes really featured. Obviously, we saw Dara get silver that day. And you won the team, under 23 men won the team prize as well, didn't they?
That's right,
team competition as well. So, you know, you really did perform. And ever since then, I have just sort of seen Ireland as just this rising force.
Yeah, I think that was a bit of a turning point, all right, because it was some great performances. The atmosphere, I don't know if you were over at it, but the atmosphere was super on the day.
I wasn't. There's one of my regrets not going over there.
Yeah, it was, in my eyes, it's what Eurocross should be about. And again, come back to a point that I made earlier, I think all of these championships need to be in locations where you've got a big crowd and you've got a knowledgeable crowd. And I think one of the downfalls we've probably seen with the likes of Eurocross and maybe Worldcross over the last few years is they're in locations where you've got maybe 50 people watching. Worldcross in Serbia a couple of years ago was pretty drab affair, I'd have to say. But yeah, going back to the point is, like, I suppose that was definitely a turning point, and it showed that Irish athletes could go to a European Championships and be competitive. And it certainly, it's lit a fire of motivation under a lot of people that they know that it's not just a case of I can qualify for Eurocross and get an Irish singlet and you know, that's the box ticked. That's the first step. You need to go there now. And it's funny because I've been involved with the team management at Eurocross for the last 6 or 7 years. And that sort of team talk that we have on the Friday night when we arrive at the championship is very different now than it was 7 years ago. Like, there's a real sense of expectation when we go there, is that we're not just there filling spots. We have, you know, specific targets, and people are expecting to get medals individually and team-wise and expected to contribute with that. So it's not just a case of being there and enjoying the occasion. It's very much you're here to do business and here to be successful. Like, I mean, the model that we're all following when it comes to Eurocross is the UK. I mean, Team GB, when they go to Eurocross, you know, if you make a GB team, you're pretty unlucky probably not to come back without a medal of some description, be it a team or individual. So, that's the sort of aspirations we have of getting that sort of medal haul relative to our population size as well.
It's good to hear you as Ireland as a nation is still putting quite a lot of importance on the European Cross, and it's a part of every top athlete's calendar.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the ultimate development event for a middle distance runner. You know, it should be your first opportunity to taste international competition. And it's great that you have those three levels, that you've got junior, under 23 and senior. I think the under 23, the addition of that under 23 category is really important, because it keeps athletes competitive in that really difficult period when you come out of junior, to when you want to be a fully fledged senior. And yeah, it's a brilliant event. It's one of my favorite weekends of the year. And so hopefully we'll have plenty more action in Portugal in a couple of weeks' time.
Absolutely. And then Emmett, just finally, I've got to ask, hardest event to coach from the 800 up to the marathon? You've kind of experienced it all. What do you think is the most challenging event to get the best out of someone?
I think it's the 800 meters. And I only coach about three 800 meter athletes. I just think that balance that you've got to get right of pure speed, the tolerance and all the different physiological aspects that go into an 800, I think is the most difficult. In my opinion, the further you go up the distance, the easier it becomes to coach, because you can lean on the science a little bit more, particularly with marathon runners. You know, you can really lean on the science in terms of looking at running economy and all these different metrics. When you go to 800, you don't have those crutches to deal with. And I think that for me is the most difficult one. 1500 is probably where, you know, a little bit less difficult and so on as you go up the distances. So that would be my tuppence on the situation. I think it's a tricky one to get right.
I'm surprised. The 800 is very, very difficult, of course. But the 5000, especially just looking here in Britain, we have always struggled. You know, we're still yet to get consistently men and women sort of really, the women actually much, much better than on the men's side, getting them down towards that sort of 13-minute mark. That is difficult. And like you say, that, but you've even highlighted it with that balance with Dara and, you know, exploring his physiology and realizing where you were going wrong.
It's interesting because, I mean, I had this conversation in Tokyo with a few people. Is Irish 5K and 10K running is actually, relative to our population and everything else, is quite strong at the minute. And I think if you look at GB, you know, been probably pretty critical about it. Their 5K and 10K times relative to 8:15 and relative to the marathon, that's the event that they're probably lacking in at the minute. And you know what the reason is for that, I'm not sure. It's definitely, you know, considering how good, like say the Eurocross, really competitive at Eurocross every year, loads of good 1500 meter times, and it's not translating quite up to 5K and 10K. So that would be, I think, where you'd like to see GB athletes probably focus in terms of improvement over the next while, and probably more so on the men's side. I think the women, like you said, are actually, you know, you'd Hannah Nuttall was really competitive at Worlds, and you have a lot of girls in that sort of low fifteens and sub 15 in the UK. But yeah, the lads would probably have a bit of scope to improve. So hopefully with the wheelers, we can help improve that a little bit over the next couple of months.
I think people will be disappointed we haven't talked about the wheelers enough, but is that going to be their game plan, that, you know, still sticking those boys, obviously an incredible half marathon from Charlie, still sticking those boys in the 5 and the 10, or will it be longer?
Yeah, I think ultimately they're going to go to longer distances, but initially it'll be try and improve those shorter distance times a little bit more. Mm. Like ultimately, if you're going to be really competitive in half marathon and certainly full marathon, there's certain markers you need to be hitting over 5K and 10K. You need to be well under, you know, well down into the 27s over 10K, down close to that sort of 13.10s, 13.0s over 5K. And I think if you haven't hit those benchmarks over the shorter stuff, it's harder to be competitive in the long stuff. So, yeah, a little bit more improvement for over the short stuff. And ultimately, I think the long distance is probably where we'd like to see them going, hopefully.
Good stuff. Well, Emmett, thank you very much for this one, and hopefully see you soon.
Hopefully. Thanks so much, Matt. Cheers.